Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest in this hour on church and culture has written really quite an amazing book, very courageous book, very wise book. Her name is Jeannie Ewing, and she is from Fort Wayne, Indiana. She currently resides up there in the nowhere land of northern central Indiana. She has written a book from Sophia Press, which came out a few months ago, entitled From Grief to Grace, The Journey from Tragedy to Triumph. And I want to warn listeners that I finished reading this book today, and I was quiet for a while after I finished it. It was very powerful. Jeannie tells a very, very personal story about the birth of her Sarah. Jeannie, welcome to Church and Culture.
Hi, Dale. Thanks for having me today.
Well, all I can say is that you put your heart out there for everybody to see, and I think that's what makes your book so good. There's nothing like honesty in writing, and that's what readers want. They want honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just tell our listeners what it is that your book came out of, the experience. Do you mind just briefly telling us?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So after my youngest daughter, Sarah, was born 3 years ago, I was in a really dark place spiritually. I was wrestling with a lot of the questions that I address in my book. And it was about 2 weeks postpartum. I was having one of these, you know, interior temper tantrums.
Oh, wait a minute now. You haven't told our listeners what your daughter's condition was when she was born.
Sure. So Sarah was born with a rare genetic condition called Apert syndrome, which neither my husband nor I had ever heard of until she was born. And it affects the development of the skull bones and fingers and toes. So those are fused prematurely, the skull.
So you have fused fingers and toes, which I can't pronounce that condition.
Syndactyly.
And then, prematurely fused cranial plates. What is
that? Yeah, so that's called craniosynostosis. That's the medical term. There are other forms of craniosynostosis that are not syndromic related.
And this is extremely rare?
Well, it occurs in between 1 and 60,000 and 1 and 200,000 live births. The statistics vary from peer-reviewed journals. So,
but this results in quite a disfigurement, I understand.
Yes, especially facial features and also the limbs and the fingers. There can be other bones that are fused that you just find out as the child gets older and they might not be able to move. For instance, Sarah's range of motion with her shoulders is locked, so that might be a fused bone that we might have to find out.
How old is she now?
Sarah's 3. And she's had 6 surgeries, which people with Apert have between 20 and 60 surgeries throughout their lifetime. Right.
And so you've been through a lot with your husband, who writes a little very beautiful, powerful little afterword at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But you describe in the book that you have to have a C-section, which you weren't looking forward to, but what really got to you was the silence that filled the room after the baby was crying, that nobody was saying anything about the baby.
Yeah, exactly.
So you knew there was something wrong.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I couldn't see anything, of course, and I couldn't move because of the spinal tap. I was still pretty numb. But the on-call pediatrician, so not a doctor I was familiar with, she came over to me as they were stitching me up, and she said, "Do you have any genetic disorders in your family?" And I just really naively was like, why would she ask me this? So I said, well, no, of course not. So that was, after that, she kind of walked away. She took my husband off to the side. I could see them in the corner of my eye. And then Ben went over to see Sarah. He came over to me, and I could see the concern in his face. But he said very appropriately, it was just perfect. He said, well, it looks like there might be something different that Sarah's got some problems. Her fingers and her toes are fused together, and her face looks a little different, but I think she's going to be all right, and we'll get through whatever is to come. So that was really helpful that he
struck a positive note about a very sad situation.
Exactly. So he was able to bring the reality to me because he knew that I was longing to be able to hold Sarah and to see for myself and to just kind of process everything that was going on. And yet he brought that reality in a very charitable way. So that was how it all started. And then
so you naturally went through a lot emotionally. So let's go back to where you were when you were talking earlier when I interrupted you. Go back to that spot.
Sure. Yeah, sure. So after the birth of Sarah, about 2 weeks postpartum, I was just doing this kind of interior pity party. And, in my prayers, I would kind of whine and complain to God about, why did you pick this for our daughter and for our family? And why this just isn't fair. And on and on it went. And I was just so angry. I did a lot of crying, a lot of not yelling at people, but just yelling at God. And at one point, the Lord spoke very clearly to me. He said, okay, Jeannie, you have two choices. You can choose to continue doing what you're doing, and you'll eventually become a victim of life. You're going to blame me. You're going to blame other people. You're going to blame the circumstances. You're always going to blame somebody, and you're going to be mad about everything. Every misfortune, every mistake, you're just going to blame somebody, and that's being a victim. Or you can choose victory in my cross and understand that suffering and the path to the cross is hard, but there is hope and there is strength in the resurrection, which comes after, of course, after the death, the mystical death. And so there was just something about that clarification from God that gave me the courage and the strength to say, okay, you're right. I need to get over this pity party, and I need to make different choices.
But, Jeannie, part of the honesty in the book is how you describe your reluctance to take Sarah out in public, your fear of people seeing her looking the way she looked. And you're very honest in the book about what I'm sure any reader would say, oh, of course. I mean, of course you're going through that. But you struggled with it. And you got to the point where you, I guess, embraced it. Is that fair to say?
Sure. Absolutely.
How long did that take?
I'm not really sure, because I do remember when Sarah was a fresh newborn, it was very, as you described, it was just really tough for me. I was very embarrassed. I wanted to kind of protect her, and I didn't want to talk about it with people I didn't know. And there just came a point, maybe when she was not quite a year old, where I realized, oh, I don't mind talking about this anymore. This is the reality. Yes, her fingers look this way. Yes, her face looks this way. I'm sure, I know people are going to look at her twice, but it's okay. I'm ready and I'm able to have this conversation. I'm not ashamed of Sarah. This is who she is. There's a reason that God wants to use this experience in her life and in our family for the good.
And another thing you talk about honestly is how hard it is, how hard it was for people to talk to you or react to you about how Sarah was born.
Mm-hmm.
That's a natural difficulty. I'm sure you'd agree. But
yeah.
Did you have experience of somebody taking a different tack other than what you described in talking to you?
Well, very few people did.
Not really.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Well, tell our listeners, I'm sure they know, but what did people basically say to you?
Yeah, so it was just kind of like, they didn't talk to us at all. And these were friends that we had had for years, that kind of faded out of our life quietly.
They did?
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's just, it's the harsh truth.
Help me here. I mean, you needed them more than ever. What happened?
Yeah, I think it's because they did not know what to say or do, which most of us are that way when there's a crisis in somebody else's life. We want to help. We want to be helpful, but we don't want to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing. We don't want to invade someone's space when the grief is raw. And so I didn't really blame them for that. It was lonely. It was tough. There were a couple of people that, and still are, that really remained loyal, strong friends. And they never wavered. They were not uncomfortable with the discomfort in our family and the experience that we were going through.
So it wasn't across the board. You had some people that hung in with you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have others who at first hung back but eventually learned how to relate to it?
Yes.
That's good. What about your respective parents?
They were great. My father was the first person outside of Ben and me to meet Sarah, and he loved her right away. They have a very special relationship. And then my father-in-law, they live in Colorado. He drives out east every year in March, and it happened to coincide with when Sarah was born. So he was one of the first
people. He was there.
Yeah, he was there, I think, the day we brought Sarah home from the
hospital. Wow.
And just see him bond with Sarah. Now, my husband believes that the reason his dad responded to Sarah the way he did was that Ben had an uncle who had Down syndrome, and
yes.
He was pretty severely cognitively disabled. And so he just assumed that maybe his dad kind of remembered what it was like and just had a soft heart for her.
And, I hate to hear that people moved out of your life, but you did have some sort of close-knit community of family and friends who hung in with you. How important was that to you?
Very. Without it, I think, without their prayers, without the meals, the babysitting, the notes. Sometimes we'd get a card in the mail that said, I put a holy hour for you today. Or I offered up a mass for your family today. That was what got me through.
How did your parish handle it?
Who? How did
your parish?
They actually rallied with us right away. In fact, they pulled together this really neat fundraiser at our church that they normally used for one of the ministries, like the young adult ministry or the youth ministry. And they actually advertised it, and they donated everything to our family. So that was also an opportunity for Ben and me to kind of explain what was going on, to break the ice so that people that knew, they saw Sarah, they might have known us, or maybe even those friends that distanced themselves for a while. This was a way for us to say, this is what's going on, and this is what we're going through, and thank you all for being here, kind of thing. And then from that point on, people came up and said, thank you so much for talking about this. I didn't know what was wrong with Sarah. I didn't know what to say. And, yeah.
Well, you know, your book is just marvelous. I'm going to pick on a few things here in a minute. I hope you don't mind. I mean, I am a former college professor, and so I have to pick on something. And but what I would say about your book overall is that, you know, you did a lot of research into things like grief, depression. You did a lot of research into spirituality, and particularly the issue of suffering, which I think the central issue that you deal with in your book is just how does suffering fit into a Christian universe and into the life of a believing Catholic. And I think that the most valuable thing you've done in your book is to explain to people that our culture doesn't understand suffering and tries to pretend that it can be avoided.
Yes.
And so talk a little about how you came to that recognition?
From my own experience, just like we were talking about earlier, people that the way they responded to me and to Sarah, because seeing a six-month-old baby that just had his or her skull cut open, that's suffering, and that's the reality. And so people, even just seeing our family after Sarah's surgery, they were not comfortable with it. And that just made me, when I thought about it and reflected on it, I thought, you know, this is the way our society responds to anything that's painful or difficult or negative, any negative emotion. It's to pretend it doesn't exist or to run away. And I think the reason people responded the way they did, most people, not everyone, like I said earlier, was that they never had the proper maybe upbringing, or at least they never had the exposure.
Well, this country's never lived through a war since the Civil War.
Yes, right.
I mean, think about it. I mean, whereas Europe, all of Europe has lived through, you know, two major wars in the last century, and they understand death, suffering, deprivation,
yes,
in a way that Americans have been, you know, luckily shielded from. Of course, our men and women went overseas, but it's not the same when it comes to your own shores, your own nation.
Absolutely.
So there is a kind of an illusion that life can be lived, what, without these great tragedies?
Right. I think here that's true, just like you said. And if people do encounter suffering, usually they conceal it. There are so many forms of escapism. I mean, look at drug use, overeating, all the isms, all the addictions. I mean, from what I understand as a former counselor, it's concealing the emotional and the spiritual void by numbing ourselves, or all the video games, all the internet games, or all sorts of distractions and diversions.
Well, internet has made it much more easy, much easier, I should say, to find that place to hide. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, no question.
But what? So you recognized that suffering wasn't understood in our culture, and particularly wasn't understood in your immediate surrounding. So then you delved into the difference between grief and depression. I think that was a wonderful chapter. Could you talk to our listeners about that?
Sure. Well, I think there's a common misconception that when someone's grieving, they need an antidepressant. They're just depressed.
Yeah, you talk about going to the doctor yourself.
Right. If you can't, quote, get over it right away, whatever that means.
Right.
You know, people have different timelines, but they seem to think
right. After
the funeral, you move on and life goes on. But the truth is you never get over grief.
No such thing as closure, I say.
Right. So I think that's where there's just this common misconception in our society about everything that has to do with sadness must be depression if it doesn't go away. Well, now, what I try to talk about in the book is, first, I differentiate between grief and depression, meaning that grief is always triggered by a loss in life. And there are some symptoms that manifest in grief that also coincide with the clinical diagnosis for major depressive disorder. But it's not really a clinical diagnosis, grief is not, unless it's something called complicated grief, which means there are suicidal tendencies.
I had never heard of that, by the way, until you...
Yeah, well...
That is actually a clinical phrase, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think it's actually... There's another disorder, like something... Some bereavement disorder. But it all occurs when the person is experiencing obsessions about the loss, the person that they lost or the situation, whatever the loss was. And they ruminate over it. They can't function. So this is interfering with their daily lives. And like I said, they might have suicidal tendencies. They might lose their proper hygiene, eating habits. They're not taking care of themselves. And this happens consistently for 2 weeks or more. Well, yeah, then you should probably go see a professional and get some help, professional help.
Did you ever go on antidepressants yourself?
Have I ever? No, I haven't. But we do have depression and bipolar disorder in my family, so it's something that's always on the forefront of my mind that, as, you know, if I ever got into this deep ravine emotionally, I would probably, and I got stuck. It's about getting stuck there, where you just
right.
can't get out of it. Now, depression can be triggered. It's triggered by the neurotransmitters in the brain, so it doesn't necessarily have to have a reason. The person that's clinically depressed doesn't have to have a particular trigger. It's just, it's more biological and physiological. But grief is always triggered by loss. And it's, and I believe that grief is also kind of the spiritual component of how we make sense of life and death and the afterlife, because grief really makes us confront those questions. Who is God? And did my loved one go to heaven? Do I believe, what do I believe in? Because a lot of people are kind of nominal Christians or Catholics and don't necessarily believe or really have not adopted deeply the tenets of the faith.
I'm talking to Jenny Ewing, whose new book is something, a book that I strongly, strongly recommend. It's entitled From Grief to Grace, The Journey from Tragedy to Triumph. It's published by Sophia. If you go to the Sophia Press website, you'll get an opportunity to buy not only Jeannie's book, but another book for the price of one. And, of course, it's available at the typical places like on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. One thing I like what you do, is this is what makes your book so helpful to many people, is that you apply what you learned to other forms of suffering, including infertility, miscarriage, abortion, divorce, death, I mean, just about anything you can think of. Did you find it hard to sort of create a bridge from what you experienced to those other experiences?
No, because a lot of those things that I listed in Chapter 2 are things I've experienced myself.
Oh.
Not all of them, but many of them. Or I know people, I'm really close to people
right.
who have had abortions or have gone through divorces. And again, it was like a common theme that I saw, that grief isn't just about death. Which again, when I was looking up other resources about grief, every resource, or almost all of them, pertained specifically to death. That was it. It was how to cope with death, what happens in the process of someone dying. You know, there are lots of good publications, books, and resources from hospice care and from the nursing perspective, etc., counseling perspective, but I couldn't find anything that explained that grief can happen even when somebody doesn't die. It can happen when you lose a job.
I like your critique of Kubler-Ross.
Right.
Tell our listeners a little about what you think of that.
Well, you know, I mean, in college we just learned the basic five stages of grieving, and we had to memorize them, and they were all presented to us as if they occurred chronologically. And at the time I thought, well, yeah, I guess that makes sense. But then when I got older and then I looked back on my life and understood kind of the ebb and flow of grief within my own family with addictions and mental illness, and then, of course, when we had Sarah, I realized, no, this is so much more complex than stages. It's multifaceted, and it's deep.
And it's cyclical. It's cyclical, and it never really goes away.
Right, exactly. So some people ask me sometimes, oh, how have you gotten to this place of triumph over tragedy and tell everybody, and I say, you know what, it is cyclical. It's a process for me too. So everything I've written about, I regress.
I mean, you wake up one day and you're like, you feel like you've gone three steps backwards, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I want people to understand, this isn't, especially what I talk about in my book, this isn't like, okay, you go through these spiritual principles, you come to the end and you'll always stay there.
Yeah, or I'm healed, I'm over it.
Yeah, right. Because that doesn't usually happen. Not unless we become saints and then God takes us to heaven, which is rare for now. So you know what I'm saying. So
yeah, I do.
It's almost like I want people to understand that this is hard work. It's something you have to do on a daily basis. There are some days where, for instance, abandonment to divine providence is easier for me than holy indifference. there are some days when humility is just the battle that I'm facing. And so it just depends. It's just important for us to be very close to the sacraments and have a very deep, disciplined prayer life so that we can become aware of ourselves and we can be honest with ourselves and notice these changes and what we need to work on through grace.
Coming up to our break, I'm talking to Jeannie Ewing. She's lives up in North Central Indiana. She wrote a book called From Grief to Grace, The Journey from Tragedy to Triumph, which is prompted by the birth of her daughter, Sarah, with Apert. Is that how you pronounce it? Apert syndrome?
Apert.
Apert syndrome, which involves fused fingers and toes and disfigurement of the face caused by fused cranial plates. And how many operations have you had so far, has Sarah had?
Six.
And you say in your book that she just comes out happy as a lark on the other side.
Yes, she does. She's very
busy. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
I know that our listeners will, when this interview is over, be praying for you, as I will. We're going to take a short break, come back and talk more to Jeannie Ewing.
The Church's teaching on the theology of the body is needed now more than ever, and the International Theology of the Body Congress will show you how TOB can solve the challenges facing families today. Join Al Cresta, the Theology of the Body Institute, Catholic leaders, experts, and enthusiasts for love, mercy, and the gift of the family, September 23rd through the 25th at the Ontario Convention Center in Southern California. Find out more at tobcongress.com. Early bird registration ends July 31st, so register today at tobcongress.com.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In Luke 5, Jesus invites Peter, weary from a night of fruitless fishing, back out onto the Sea of Galilee to cast his nets one more time and trust Jesus for the results. To cast into the deep is to let go of our own opinions, desires, and the way things or people should be. To cast into the deep, even where we have already fished with no results, is to let go of independence, autonomy, and self-determination. The sooner we realize that our Beloved is holding us in His hands, the sooner we can get about the business of doing our Father's will. The sooner we will become disciples. Proverbs sums up this great secret lesson learned by the saints. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to Him and He will make your path straight. Let go and trust the Lord to direct your activities and your life. He knows what He's doing.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
You remember the day you first laid eyes on her. They handed you the keys and you drove back home for everyone to admire. And although the memories have been made, it's time to pass the torch to someone else. Consider donating your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Even if it's not running, we'll take care of everything from pickup to your tax receipt. Just call 866-628-CARS to show you just how easy it is to donate. That's 866-628-CARS. And mention Ave Maria Radio.
I'm back with Jeannie Ewing, and we're talking about her book from Sophia Press, new book, From Grief to Grace, The Journey from Tragedy to Triumph, about how she and her husband have dealt with her daughter, Sarah, who was born with Apert syndrome. And Jeannie, I want to pick on you for a couple points in your book, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'll quote you. You say, "Happiness is not the highest order for us to seek and strive for because it is transitory and emotive. Joy supersedes the mere feeling of happiness because it is rooted in the spirit of one's being rather than in the fickle feelings that flutter in the heart." Well, happiness is not a feeling, but yet you're identifying it as a feeling. I mean, you talk about the wisdom of our Catholic catechism. And if you look up happiness, human happiness, in our catechism, it will tell you that it's a state of being that is only finally perfected in the presence of God and is imperfectly perfected here on earth. but is related to virtue, the moral life, and the relationship to God. What you've done here is to accept the secular definition of happiness and just replaced it by joy in order to avoid the identification of happiness with feeling.
Well, you're right. I guess I should have specified that. I should have said in the book.
Second edition, you can fix it.
I can do that, right. So I should have specified the secular definition of happiness is
right.
This. And really, if you think about it, happiness, you're right, is a noun, so it's a state of being. But people say, I feel happy.
Right.
Then it is a feeling. I feel
yeah.
sad.
And that's what we call in philosophy a category mistake.
Right.
And
also, you're right. The catechism is clear about happiness in terms of the church's view of what that is. I was coming from a perspective thinking that most readers are going to read this,
right.
And they're going to see happiness and think immediately, like I do, of what the world tells
me. And you're absolutely right about that. You're
so
absolutely
that's part
right.
of the reason I wanted to differentiate between happiness and joy, because a lot of times in my life, I felt happy and this euphoria, so to speak.
Yeah, but that's not happy. That's not what we call happiness.
It's not what the church calls happiness.
And, I'm just saying, let's not give up on the word happiness here. And even if it's been totally ruined in the culture and has been identified with a feeling state or a psychological state, I think we can redeem it. We can redeem the word happiness. Just like you've redeemed suffering. I mean, one thing your book is to explain suffering in a way that it's not something you run away from.
Right.
I mean, you're helping to redeem the word suffering. So that is a small matter. We can move on. I'm done with my lesson.
I was going to say one more thing. You think about how we can expect to be reasonably happy in this life, but supremely happy in the next.
Yes.
So, yes, there is a redemption of the word happiness, or what happy means, in the eyes of the church. But when I think of reasonably happy, again, it's different than when I experience joy, because joy can mingle with sorrow.
Yeah.
And it does for me.
Yeah.
I can be
well,
happy.
You know, to give you an idea of how different our conception of happiness is from that of the Greeks, the Romans, the medievals, and the churches, in the heyday of classical Greek and Roman philosophy, they used to debate whether a person could be happy while being roasted in a fire, being tortured,
mm-hmm.
because they identified happiness with virtue. And so if someone maintained their virtue while being roasted alive, they could still be called happy.
Right.
So that's pretty extreme. Now, point number two. This is the only other thing in your book that I want to pick at you about. And this is sensitive, so let's be careful here. You talk about God's will and suffering, and you talk about your daughter's syndrome, and you write this, because God, is omniscient. He already knew that Sarah would be born with Apert syndrome. He is also omnipotent, which meant that he could have altered that diagnosis either prenatally or any time afterward. And this is the sentence I want to ask you about. He may have perfectly willed for Sarah to have Apert syndrome, knowing that she would endure, or he may have permissively willed for the genetic mutation. By the way, the or there is huge. The or.
It is.
And to occur, also knowing that her journey with a rare condition would be precisely the means by which she would arrive in heaven someday. Now, question. I have a hard time, theologically, and even just from the point of view of my own understanding of God, accepting that he wills, that is, perfectly wills, as you put it, these kinds of things to be. I have no problem with what's on the other side of the or in your sentence. He may have permissively willed for the mutation. I get the sense that's something you struggled with when you wrote the book.
I think at the time that I wrote that, I just didn't know. I was in a place where I wanted to be okay with either one of those as a possibility. Now, I understand pure theology, God's perfect will means that he doesn't will any suffering, doesn't want anything to be a result of pain and anguish and brokenness, and because those are consequences of sin. And even in the, you know, even the earth, I mean, all of creation has some semblance of
it's fallen.
Semblance of the first sin.
It's fallen. Yeah.
So yeah, of course, if you're talking pure theology and you're thinking logically, so we're talking, like you were talking about philosophically, no, of course he didn't perfectly will for Sarah to have that. But when I was writing that sentence, I was kind of trying to take myself out of a black and white state of thinking. And I thought, well, what if he did? What if
yeah.
Apert syndrome really wasn't the affliction that I thought it was?
Right.
Yes, it is in terms of the surgeries and the pain that Sarah has had to go through and still will. So yes, in that sense, no, I didn't believe, even as I wrote that, I did not believe he perfectly willed for her to go through surgeries and then to have the pain and the swelling and all the medications and the post-operative care. No, of course he didn't. But in terms of the disease itself, when I was thinking of Apert syndrome itself, maybe he did. I didn't know at the time. I see now.
I see it. If I was your editor, I would have had you add some of the things you're saying right now.
Mm-hmm.
And again, second edition. But it's a profound question, and I'm glad you raised it. It was part of the honesty of your book that you did. And I think the big issue sort of hovering over this is the fall of man.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the world is not as God intended it to be.
Mm-hmm.
because of original sin. Now, moving on. You deal with a couple of what are classics of spirituality, including Father de Caussade.
Uh-huh.
I think the book is Abandonment to God. Is that correct?
To Divine Providence.
To Divine Providence. And you have a wonderful quote in here, or you have a wonderful thought, and that is about living in the present moment as if there were nothing to expect beyond it. I must tell you that in my own life experience and the things I've gone through, I find that to be absolutely crucial. Because with the thought behind it that the next moment is never guaranteed. The next day is never guaranteed. This is all we have right here. And when did you and how did you come across embracing that idea?
Well, when Sarah was about 18 months old, there was a little girl with Apert in Kansas City who died unexpectedly. And at that point, I thought, oh my gosh, that could be Sarah. It just, for some reason, I knew it in the back of my mind. But when this little girl, who is pretty mild, just like Sarah is, in terms of she didn't need a lot of extra medical equipment and she was cognitively developing, alongside her peers and everything, same with Sarah, and yet she just died in her sleep. Nobody knew why. And so I thought, oh my gosh, that could be Sarah any day. And from that point on, I realized I have to really be grateful for the fact that I have Sarah today.
Every moment.
Because I don't know, and not just Sarah. Of course, that extended to everybody in my family and my neighbors and my parish and the life that God gave me. So I began to appreciate small things. And maybe it could have even just been a few seconds, a fleeting moment with my daughters, or outside a rare bird or something that I saw or heard.
I get that. And, you bring up two other people who, frankly, I'll be honest, I didn't know. Father Solanus Casey, who you tell his wonderful story. But before that, I believe he's Polish, Father Tajusz Deser. Is that how you say his name?
He's Polish, yes.
And you have a quote from him And I hope you remember the book, because I want to read it, the name of the book. And the quote is, "An obvious sign of attachments is also your sadness in situations when God takes something away from you. He will, therefore, take that by which you are enslaved."
Yes.
"Hence, everything that is your greatest enemy, that which causes your heart not to be free for him. It is when you start to accept this and do it cheerfully that you will become more and more free." And in your case, what was taken away from you was your idea or ideal of a normal child. Is that correct?
Exactly. Exactly.
What do you remember the book that came from?
You know what? It didn't come from a book that I quoted. I quoted it from the Magnificat magazine, that periodical.
Okay.
So I
then I'll write to one of the editors of Magnificat,
yeah,
who's a friend of mine.
Yeah, my editor even asked me about that. He said, "Do you know where they got that?" I said, "No,
it's right.
Them when you know."
Well, we'll find it. But that is such a wonder. I mean, gosh, I can relate to that, and I bet our listeners can too. And it's a reminder how good things, they're not bad in themselves, but good things can get in the way of your spiritual growth.
Yes.
You know, because there's nothing wrong with making money, nothing wrong with work, nothing wrong with play, nothing wrong with hobbies, nothing wrong with any of that. But good things can become too important to you. And if they're taken away and your sadness becomes evidence of how you were, as he puts it, enslaved.
Exactly.
Wow.
That was very humbling for me when I read that. I thought, oh, that makes sense of why I get discouraged so easily, because I have these inordinate attachments to people or relationships
What you think your daughter should look like.
Exactly.
Now, did you say, I thought you said that Sarah is three now, but she is developing cognitively in a way like other children?
Yes, yes.
That's wonderful. So this cranial thing doesn't impact the brain? Doesn't impact
that? It can. So that's why I was going to say that, you know, she has a dozen or more specialists, and they all marvel at her because
that's great.
She's kind of an anomaly within an anomaly.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, she's got this rare disease, but most people with APER have slightly below average or significantly below average IQ, and many of them have trachs and they're in wheelchairs. Some of them can't talk, hearing aids. She's she's just doing so remarkably that everybody notices it.
Well, I think it's a tribute to you and Ben.
Some say that.
I'll say it because I have a very special needs son who wasn't supposed to get past seventh grade. We adopted him from Romania, and he just graduated from high school. He's in college now. And I think it's just obvious that his mother did the right thing with him.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, went to all the specialists and all the therapies that he needed.
Exactly.
You know? And I hope you play Mozart for Sarah.
You know, my girls like, they like Baroque music, Renaissance,
Vivaldi.
Classical. Oh, yeah. In fact, my oldest daughter really likes, she's asked me about specific instruments, Renaissance mm-hmm. instruments, and that's not my forte, so I had to look up all these old instruments.
Like viola da gamba and things like
that. Yes.
Yeah.
But they both like a variety of music.
Harpsichords.
Yes. Yep.
Well, that's good. I think that, you know, music like Mozart and Haydn and the Baroque is good for the brain at that age.
Sure.
Father Solanus Casey.
Uh-huh.
Tell us a little about him and why he impacted you so much.
Father Solanus was a Capuchin friar, and he lived at the Detroit Monastery for most of his life. I mean, he was in New York, and then he also came to our diocese in Huntington, Indiana, for a while towards the latter part of his life. But what struck me when I read one of the three biographies that have been written about him is he was such a humble person. and his simplicity really was striking to me. He was so unpretentious. He didn't mind that he was assigned the menial tasks like scrubbing toilets and opening the door. I mean, you know, he was a priest alongside his other brother priests, but he wasn't necessarily as gifted intellectually as they were, and so he was not given tasks of preaching and studying and research and analyzing theology or anything like that. And he was okay. He was happy, to use the word happy. He really was.
He really, in the real sense, yes.
In the real sense. He was contented with that. He was at peace with this. This was a way that he felt like he was giving back to the Lord. And he just had this resignation of everything that happened to him. Apparently he had a very painful disease that afflicted, I think, one of his legs or his hip. Nobody ever knew until he died, because he never complained about it. Never went to the doctor. He just, here we go, offered it up, like I talk about in my book, too. And so there were just so many parts of Father Solanas' life that were so exemplary in holiness that I was drawn to his way of life, and I wanted to be more like him. And he is now a venerable. And so, you know, privately, I would occasionally ask for his intercession, but he was a significant part of Sarah's birth story. So that's why I included him in this book as well, because I thought, you know, we can learn an important spiritual lesson about grief from his belief and his understanding of confidence in God's timing. So thanking God ahead of time, that was another thing I thought, oh my gosh, I don't do that. But his faith was such that he was able to thank God for whatever happened, whether it was favorable toward what he wanted or not, and it didn't disturb him peace. It didn't disturb his joy.
So, well, I wanted to tell you that I just Googled that quote from the Polish priest. The first thing that came up was your book. But
really?
I went a little further and found that Father, again, I'm going to stumble, Tadeusz Dasier, has a book entitled The Gift of Faith, which I'm guessing is the source of that quote. There's
mm-hmm.
another one, however, called Amazing Nearness, Meditations on the Eucharist, and those are the only two in English. So I imagine we can find, for the second edition, we can find the source of that quote. Now,
yes, you're giving me lots of good ideas to make sure I add and clarify things in the book.
And God willing, there will be a second edition. Now,
mm-hmm.
you give the best explanation, and I'm a convert, age 34, so I didn't grow up with all this stuff, but you give the best explanation of offer it up that I've ever read. And because I kept hearing, once I became a Catholic, I kept hearing people say offer it up. I didn't know what they were talking about. Like, is it like a basketball? You throw it up in the air, you know, or you like, I mean, offer it up. What does that mean? But you actually explain it. Say a little bit about how you do that.
Well,
and it is a strange phrase in my book, in my view.
Yes, it is. But for me, it was a cliche because I'm a cradle.
Because you grew up with it. Yeah.
I heard it all the time at Catholic school and from my mom and my grandparents. Well, it's not something that's easy to do. So this, it sounds almost like the explanation almost sounds like oversimplified. However, it basically means that we unite our sufferings to the cross, that we allow the Lord to enter into our own wounds for the sake of our own sanctification, for the sake of someone else's sanctification or redemption even. And it's a way that we can participate in his passion mystically. So it comes from that scripture that talks about we compensate for the lack of the sufferings of Christ. I'm paraphrasing very loosely. But that doesn't mean that Christ's sufferings were incomplete. But what it means is that all of us have an opportunity to, out of love, unite our own struggles and trials and pain and illnesses as an offering, as a gift of love to Jesus. And he uses those offerings to transform us and to also transform others when we offer as a prayer. But it's easier said than done. It's easier to say, oh, we'll just offer it up, than it is when you are in excruciating pain and to, in the moment, say, I'm truly going to give this to you, Lord. Please help me suffer through this as long as you will for me to endure it. It's harder to do it in the moment of pain. But
it also, and it also, to a convert anyway, sounds sort of like, well, get over it, you know.
Yeah, it kind of does. And
almost a dismissal of it,
kid,
you know.
Yeah, I felt that way when I was a child. That's why I kind of tuned it out when my mom would say it over and over.
But, and the way I understood what you said is that offered up means that you place before God that which is part of your experience, part of what life has brought you, and that you should not have the pride to think that somehow you should be exempt from such experiences.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
I mean, again, it was the first time it kind of bell rung for me on that particular phrase. And I mean, I've been a Catholic now a long time. I should have rung that bell a long time ago, but you know, we are always learning, aren't we?
Yep, I learned from you today.
Well, thank you, and I learned a lot from you having read your book. And again, I want to encourage our listeners to take, you know, to buy and to read Jeannie Ewing's book, because it's a kind of book that I think everyone has a moment in life, or many moments in life, when they need some guidance through grief, through tragedy. The book's entitled From Grief to Grace, The Journey from Tragedy to Triumph, from Sophia. And again, if you go to the Sophia website, Sophia Press website, you can get it and another book for the price of one. And this is a kind of book, if you have a friend who's, you know, been whacked around, going through a very hard time, hand it to them. And one thing I like also in your book is that, Jeannie, when you talk about going to people and offering help, you say you have to have a great deal of sensitivity about it. In other words, you can't get people who have had abortions, for example.
Right.
And you recognize that there's a great deal of individualized approach that has to be taken toward every person.
Yes. I mean, that's another reason why I think that when we are called to walk with someone and be with someone in their pain, it's a unique calling, because it's not something most of us know how to do well. We kind of pull these phrases out that we've heard or people have said to us, like, everything happens for a reason, or it's going to be okay, call me if you need me, and that end up not being helpful. But when we realize that the best gift we can give to someone who's suffering is the gift of our presence, just sitting with them, allowing them to cry, allowing them to vent, even if they get really mad, and not flinching or wincing when they do, not taking it personally, but just giving them the gift of empathy and just letting them know that if they want us to talk, we will. If they just want us to sit there and listen, that's what we're here for. Because I know that was a profound gift to me when Sarah was born, with a couple of friends that would come over. And I would just cry, and I would just kind of process out loud what I was going through and why I was angry or what I was hurting about. And the grief was raw, and they were okay with that. I'll never forget it.
Well, I'll never forget reading your book, and I think I want to especially encourage our listeners to look it up, From Grief to Grace, Sophia Press. Jeannie Ewing, prayers for you and both your daughters, especially Sarah, in her very brave walk through the world. And I hope we'll hear more about how she's progressing as the days pass.
Thank you.
And to all of our listeners, this time, this day, next week, come back. Church and Culture. Thanks once again, Jeannie.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
Peggy Stanton, and I'm inviting you to join me on Power from the Pews when I interview the people who are engaged in remarkable ministries that are making a real difference in their parishes and the world. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Light of the East. Weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the Eastern Catholic Churches are relatively small and few in America. There are ways to ensure their growth and vitality, and the first place to look is to their liturgies.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan. One of the greatest gifts God has given to us is wisdom. According to the Catechism, wisdom is a spiritual gift which enables one to know the purpose and the plan of God. So how do we obtain this wisdom for our lives? In a dozen places, the Old Testament tells us the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Fear of the Lord means being humble before God. St. James tells us that we can likewise approach God in humbleness, seeking wisdom. He wrote, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask God." Let us pray that when we do not know the right direction to go or the course of action to take, we will humble ourselves and trust that God will give us the wisdom we need for the situation at hand. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan. You can find us on Facebook or at cbsmich.org.
Bring your family and friends out for a memorable weekend of fun at the St. Joseph Festival in Dexter. This three-day weekend event starts Friday, July 15th, and with over 500 volunteers, it's massive. There's entertainment, exhibitions, and events for all age groups, and admittance to the festival and parking is absolutely free. It's your 38th annual festival. Go to stjos.com to learn all they have to offer. That's July 15th through the 17th, stjos.com.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
I hope God's grace touches many people this weekend. Draw us to unite and receive the Lord Jesus in the Holy Eucharist and in the holy words of Scripture. For these are the ways God usually strengthens and builds up his people. Someone once asked Jesus, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" He said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Do this and you'll live." Boils down to this: love God and love your neighbor. Which naturally leads to the question, just exactly who is my neighbor? And Jesus answered this in a parable you know well. But I'm asking you, do you live this out in your daily life? A man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho through bandit country and fell victim to robbers who beat him and left him half dead. A priest went down the road, but when he saw him, he passed by.